The members of the committee will be introducing themselves to you. In the meantime, after they do that, you introduce yourself and then just explain to us very briefly why you think we should really consider you for the committee. Your relevant experience in the relevant field and other related matters. Thank you very much. We've got Dr. Ambrosin there. He's not there, but he's coming in. The rest of the members, their names appear there in front of them, so you can readily identify them. So the board is in your court. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, on the side, yeah. There.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Janice Cherry. I'm currently a senior lecturer in development studies at the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University in Port Elizabeth. And I think more relevant for the Human Rights Commission is that for my whole adult life, I have been a consistent and stubborn defender and advocate of human rights. I am involved at the moment in an academic position, but I have maintained involvement in international training in civil society organizations and have been recently, well, in the past few years, into some of the worst conflict-ridden countries in the world and have seen how human rights are violated there. And this, for me, has made me all the more committed to the upholding and defending of our constitution and the Bill of Rights in the South African constitution. And I can tell you that having come back from countries like the DRC and the occupied territories of Palestine, I actually feel an enormous sense of gratitude to be living in a country where human rights are upheld through a Bill of Rights. So I see our constitution and the role of the Human Rights Commission as absolutely critical in terms of monitoring and defending the human rights that are embodied in that constitution. Now, I feel that personally I'm at a stage of my life where I have been engaged in both academic work, research work, policy research for the Human Sciences Research Council, involving some human rights related research. For example, we did an extensive research project on the Communal Land Rights Act and the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act and how this impacted on the rights of rural women, whether they would get access to land, whether they would get access to participating in structures of rural governance. So that kind of policy research was very important. In addition, while I was working for the HHRC, we conducted a review of the Chapter 9 institutions on a project on the legacy of discrimination and the extent to which discrimination has been overcome in South Africa. And in that project, I was actually given the task of doing a review of the Commission on Gender Equality. So I gained some insight into how the Commission on Gender Equality functions, and we produced a report on this on the Chapter 9 institutions. I didn't conduct research myself on the Human Rights Commission, but I can tell you that the conclusion of that report was that the Human Rights Commission was the best of those Chapter 9 institutions in terms of its functioning and in terms of its ability to carry out its mandate of upholding and advancing and educating about human rights in South Africa. The other thing I should tell you is that I'm still very much an activist, and I'm not afraid to speak out openly, and I have very strong opinions on human rights issues, and I've been engaged in the last few years in various campaigns and issues, including around xenophobia last year, and against rape in terms of the 16 days campaign against violence against women, and various other campaigns. So I'm not afraid to speak my mind. I'm used to speaking in public and giving lectures. Just one other thing which I think might be of interest to the committee here is that for the university, Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, I developed a third-year course on human rights in the Department of Sociology. I have a copy here if anybody's interested in it to see how I approached it, but I think that I'm not an academic who's involved in the more arcane and high-level debates about human rights. I could more happily engage in public education and engaging with ordinary people at a grassroots level around human rights. I do, however, see the importance as well of South Africa playing a role in the international community and the importance of the Human Rights Commission in terms of its role of ensuring that the South African government honours its treaty obligations in terms of international human rights conventions. And I'm familiar with those conventions and what our responsibilities are in that regard.
Thank you. I'm going to stop you there. Let's follow the normal order. You will assist there to make more points at your question. Let's get into it.
Thank you, Dr.
Honorable
Initially, the whole issue of the relationship of the Commission and the Executive and Parliament. Clearly, as we've had discussions here, there are a lot of issues relating to the Executive responding to human rights issues, where the Commission has tried to, for example, the reporting on socio-economic rights and the tardiness of departments to respond to that, or the complaints that are laid, tardiness of government to respond to complaints by the Commission, how does one deal with that? Thirdly, the issue of whether you as a commission would litigate more on human rights issues. We once see a lot of NGOs that are taken, such as the TAC, taking the government to court. Should you be a commissioner, would you litigate more against the executive? And then the role of the commission and parliament. How do you see that? We obviously have an oversight function, and how do you see the commission in that function? Some introductory comments. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that I don't come from a legal background in terms of the niceties of the responsibilities of litigation, but I do think that the Human Rights Commission should be understood as a sort of supra-monitoring body on the issue of human rights, and that it should be prepared to intervene where necessary and to act quite strongly. Now, I'm not sure what the mechanisms are for ensuring or coercing the executive to respond to directives from the Human Rights Commission, but I think that the responsibility of the Commission is to ensure that it takes a very clear position on human rights abuses and on issues related to human rights violations, and that these are communicated through Parliament, of course, through the various committees and the enactment of legislation, giving input into that legislation. But in terms of the executive function, I think the Commission could perhaps respond more strongly and proactively in terms of ensuring, I mean, one example would be the issue of service delivery, or another would be the issue of administrative justice, that people get access to the services or the administrative competences to which they are entitled. And I don't know how the legal or legislative mechanism would work in that regard, but I think the Commission should play a role as the body which is the oversight body in relation to those issues.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
You indicated a minute ago, you told me that you did some research, I think, through the Human Sciences Research Council. Could you tell us what went wrong with the Gender Commission? And did you do this research before the time when the ad hoc review was done, finished, or thereafter? Because I would be interested to hear what happened thereafter as well.
Yeah, no, this is before the ad hoc review was done. It was some years ago, and I think already the Gender Commission was floundering with a lack of capacity and possibly some lack of very proactive leadership. However, I think things have subsequently got worse in the Gender Commission. And I don't know all the details of what's happened in the Gender Commission since then.
Okay, Brock?
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Cherry, my first question to you is, what do you consider to be your strengths and weaknesses? And the second and the last question, what do you think are the biggest challenges that face human rights and human rights commission in this country?
Well, thank you. My strengths and weaknesses, I think my strengths are dedication and a stubborn commitment to human rights and an ability also to assimilate information and to come to a clear position on the basis of assessing a lot of information. I've done a lot of research and policy work, so I can respond to an issue. I think I have a strength as well in working at a grassroots level and communicating with people. In terms of weaknesses, I am somewhat impatient, and I think stubbornness can be a weakness as well as a strength. I don't have a lot of skill or experience in the field of mediation, but my active involvement has been more in the sphere of advocacy and campaigning and organizing. So I haven't come from that background of conflict resolution. In terms of the challenges facing the Human Rights Commission and human rights in South Africa as a whole, look, there are two very fundamental challenges. And the one is the upholding of the right to security of people, and this is reflected in the high crime rate, specifically in the high levels of violence against women, in the abuse of children, and these are phenomena that the Human Rights Commission has been grappling with. But those are very fundamental human rights which we have to respond to. The other first generation rights which I'm really concerned with are also things which are dealt with by the Independent Complaints Directorate, like the unlawful detentions or torture and deaths in custody. The rate of deaths in custody in South Africa is still far, far too high. And I'm also, as a development studies practitioner, deeply concerned with the realization of second generation rights, the rights of poor people. And these are, of course, realized progressively by the state. They don't constitute abuses by the state, but the access to work, to housing, to protection for children who are AIDS orphans. And these are fundamental challenges facing us. Thank you.
Maybe just on that point, what role would you see the Commission playing as far as the realization of second-generation rights? You mentioned earlier the service delivery protests. What role should the Commission be playing in that regard? You're obviously familiar particularly with the Port Elizabeth townships. I'm sure far more clued up on them than I am. But what role would you use that as an example? What role would you see the Commission playing where there are service delivery problems, if you are. The other question is you've spoken about being independent, being stubborn, etc. There has been a situation which we were referred to earlier, where one of the commissioners disagreed with a decision of the commission and joined an NGO in litigation against the commission. I think she remained on the commission. Would you go that far? It's one thing to disagree, and I mean, a commission is obviously a collective. It reaches decisions by a majority. Obviously, there would be people disagreeing. Depending on the strength of that disagreement, somebody might decide they want to resign. but would you go as far as sort of remaining but joining others in litigation against your own body?
Well, let me start with the second question. I think it's very unlikely that I would end up in a position where I was bringing litigation against the Commission, but I do think that there are matters of principle containing human rights, and if I did get into a situation of disagreement, I would have to stay with my principles as regards human rights, and if that required resigning, I think I would probably have to resign in that situation. But I think it's unlikely. I mean, I haven't been in many institutional environments where I've had conflict with the people, the leadership of those institutions, or with my colleagues. And I think the people who are serving on the Human Rights Commission are generally people who have the same commitment to human rights. In relation to socioeconomic rights, I did actually see a very nice booklet that was produced by the Human Rights Commission on second-generation rights. I'm not sure how that has been utilized in terms of spreading knowledge, and I think that is one of the functions of the Commission, is empowering people to act collectively to realize their own rights. So what this means is that in relation to access to services, two things. The one is I think, a partnership with civil society where people are empowered to take action, to bring to the attention of the authorities, not in the form of rioting, but in the form of collective action to make their demands and their situation heard. And the second is where there is a dereliction of duty on the part of the agency or the state institution responsible, that the Human Rights Commission can intervene in those situations to make sure that those rights are immediately addressed, and that whatever, whether it's a local government or a Department of Social Development in the Northern Cape, that they then respond to that situation because the Human Rights Commission applies that pressure to them. But I do think that in terms of socioeconomic rights, that there is a role for really empowering the most powerless people in that respect to try and know their rights and know how they can be realized, what channels to go through, who they should approach, what kind of information they need in order to access whatever is due to them from whatever government department it is.
Thank you. Advocate?
Thank you, Sir President. Dr. Sherry, you've stated repeatedly that you are a human rights. You are a grassroots human rights activist. Now, in which areas do you generally operate? For instance, have you been active in that regard in the rural area? If so, would you mind telling us which one? Because I noticed that some of the work has something to do with township experiences. And secondly, in your understanding, do you see the Human Rights Commission as being quite active in the rural areas? And if you don't believe it has been as active as it should, do you have any ideas as to how that can be improved? And lastly, on the question of topical and sometimes controversial issues like cultural issues like circumcision and Ubutwala and veterinary inspection, what do you believe the Commission should do about those? Should it seek to have them done away with so that all these problems that arise around them are done away with, or is there something that you believe needs to be done to make these rights and practices to be in line with the Constitution, Bill of Rights?
Thank you. Well, in relation to the last issue of controversial cultural practices, yes, I mean, those cultural practices must be brought into line with human rights. So the Ukutwala issue, I saw a documentary on television, and I was actually quite horrified by that. And the traditional leader who was interviewed, I think, justify this by saying this is not actually, if it's practiced correctly, it's not an abuse of rights. So the question is then, when is that practice an abuse of rights, and when is it not? And if it's an abuse of rights, then it will be dealt with by the criminal law of the country. I mean, you can't abduct people and force them into actions against their will. It's against the law. So at the level at the level of action, I think the courts should deal with those issues if they're clearly an infringement of rights. At the level of civil society, of course, there is a process of engagement, which means engaging with traditional leaders and representatives of women in rural communities, women's rights organizations, to try and come to some sort of consensus. Because, of course, you can't enforce rights unless people acknowledge and accept that they are rights to be enforced. So, yeah, it's a difficult issue, but I would take a clear position where it's apparent that there is an abuse of rights being perpetrated. In terms of the rural areas, from my understanding, the Human Rights Commission has actually done quite a lot of outreach in rural areas, and I think in the Eastern Cape there has been some fieldwork and education and intervention programs. The one that I'm aware of is around the Kolobeni mining issue and the issue of land access and mining rights. But I do think that more can be done. And look, my involvement in rural areas hasn't been directly in human rights issues in the recent past, but I do have students in the master's program in development studies who are doing research on land rights, restitution of land rights, and realization of rights in various rural areas. And way back in the past, when I was involved with defending rights under apartheid, I was working with advice officers and programs in various rural towns in the Eastern Cape, Craddock and Somerset East and Cookhouse and those kinds of towns. So, yeah, I've done some research in rural areas, but I haven't been directly involved in human rights work in the last few years then.
Thank you. Dr. Amrathil, you are happy?
Just one question, which is not clear from the CV. Are you looking for, there's both full-time and part-time appointment.
Yeah.
Are you available for a full-time or only for part-time, or which would your preference be?
My preference is for full-time, because I think that the nature of the commitment to the Human Rights Commission would favour a complete focus and concentrated focus on it. I'm at the moment on a contract lectureship at the university, so I don't have an ongoing commitment to the university. If I were offered a part-time position, then I would maintain a relationship with the university in terms of some responsibilities in the postgraduate program. But I don't have a commitment to that at the moment. And the other question that I have for the Commission is that my family is in Port Elizabeth, and if I were offered a position, I would not want to move my whole family to Johannesburg. I'm not sure how the Commission functions in terms of where commissioners are required to be, but that would be a concern of mine. So if you could bear that in mind.
Yeah, we shall reflect on that. We'll try and get information, more information about that part. I want to take the opportunity to thank you very much for presenting here. Yeah. And wish you good luck.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to this interview, sir. I'm Ramantori, president of the committee. And members of the committee will introduce themselves as per their names. Those who have got names, they won't introduce themselves. The one sitting there at the extreme left is in a red tie.
He's actually on our extreme right.
He's Dr. Amrosini. He'll introduce himself.
All right.
And we want to invite you to, very briefly, you don't want thesis or anything of that sort, just briefly to the point why you think we should consider you for membership of the commission, Human Rights Commission, and also your relevant experience in human rights and related areas. You will be asked questions after that very brief synopsis, and that might also assist you to elaborate a bit further on the things that we don't have to elaborate now at the moment. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you, Chairperson. I thank you very much for the opportunity. Yes, I was nominated by one of my colleagues to make myself and asked to make myself available. It was on very short notice, and I accepted proposal by my colleague, Mr. Willie Spies from Hutter Spies. The reasons are, I would say, threefold, maybe more. I can elaborate once you ask, or members of your committee may ask some questions. But briefly, sir, I think that in the first place, you asked my exposures to human rights situation. Let's start there, because it is the Human Rights Commission. I was involved in the writing of both constitutions. In the first one, in the 93 constitution, I was in working group number 2, and our opponents on the other side were the formidable people from the prison government, namely Mr. Ramaphosa, Joe Slobo, Clayton Zimandi, etc., quite heavyweight, L.B. Sachs and Jeff Jaku. And on our side, it was only myself and Dr. Fuyun got ill, and then later he was replaced by Roof, and then also Dr. Pers Delport. Those were on our side. It was a difficult task, but in any case. In the second constitution, I was also involved with, on the other side, was Johnny De Lange, Billy Hofmeyer, Bulelani Nkuba, as well as Mushin Musa. And then on our side, it was myself and Danny Skutter. And from the DP at that stage, it was Douglas Gibson. And from the Freedom Front at that stage, it was Receive the Bill. The latter two gentlemen did not attend regularly because they had so many other committees to attend to. The experience and the exposure in both constitution writing bodies enabled me to try to comprehend and understand the difficulty we are involved with. I was not involved in chapter 2 of the Constitution, the so-called Bill of Rights chapter. To get back to why I should, why I made myself available, I've got my academic career stretches over quite a couple of years, I think 19 years all in all. I am qualified. I did my PhD in history. I was also, while I was a lecturer in history, I also taught, besides South African history, I also taught African history. We started at second year level at the Free State University. African history, the syllabus comprised the early African civilizations. In the first place, that was on the second year level. We didn't teach African history on the first year level. And on the third year level, I paid attention to the colonization or the scramble for Africa. And the third year, postgraduate honors, and after that, the liberation movements in Africa, starting right from Algeria, working down to the ANC and SWAPO at that stage. That's my academic background. Then furthermore, as far as human rights is concerned, let's get closer now to the present situation. I am also chairperson, and before I get that far, members of the committee, I didn't cross the floor. I resigned politics in 1999, started legal practice, and then I was approached by the Freedom Front to join them. The reason why they approached me was I was really substantial instrument to have principle number 34 in the constitution. I actually voted against my party
Ruth Meyer, who was the chairperson at the time, when we had to vote about the 34 principles, I voted against them, and I voted for, in favor of accepting particularly principle 34, which deals with self-determination. I ended up on the red carpet before our chief whip, Ruth Meyer, and the president then, Mr. de Klerk. And in the end, I think I won the argument by telling them I don't agree with the idea of territorial self-determination, but I think it's a democratic right for these people to try to canvass their idea. So then furthermore, since in 2004, I was in legal practice up till then full-time as an advocate, in particularly in Bloemfontein. I also worked elsewhere. And then now I'm also chairperson of the Freedom Front's Foreign Relations Committee. I was also responsible for preparing an application for membership of the United Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization called UNPO. It represents 17 nations about and about 200 million people. Important about this organization, chairperson, is that they stand for human rights, particularly human rights. The other thing is non-violence. The other thing is environmental protection. The other one is tolerance, and lastly, democracy and self-determination. And in that respect, I interact on a regular basis with representatives or other member nations of this UNPO body. In fact, my latest interaction was yesterday with Dr. Nfor from Southern Cameroon. So, Chairperson, yeah, that briefly is why I think that yes, maybe I can make a contribution academically. In the academic life, I did a lot of research. In my political life now, I have exposure to international organizations also dealing with human rights. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Honorable sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. En baie welkom weer terug, en lekker om jou weer te sien. Ek sal vir jou in Engels vraag, mag, want ek dink baie van die mense, anders is moet ons tolke hier, so.
Ja, ek sal in my gebroken Vrystaatse Engels
antwoord. Daar sê, baie welkom, dokter. May I just first ask you, clearly, you've got a history of politics and that, and I think the first question that will be put to you is, what did you do to promote human rights previously in Parliament? And then secondly, in the new parliament, how do you see, if you were to be a commissioner, how do you see the relationship or the role of the commission apropos the executive, where there's been a lot of issues relating to departments not reporting to the commission, tardiness in answering complaints, and to a certain degree, even the allegation has been made earlier that the government is, I think it was, ignoring or human rights to a certain degree. How would you, as a commissioner, improve that situation of holding the executive greater to account from the human rights perspective, whether it's by litigation, whether using the powers in terms of the Human Rights Act, and what do you see the liaison between the commission and parliament? In general, do you think that the commission up to now in the last 15 years has fulfilled its mandate? Thank you.
Chairperson, are you ready to some other questions? Would you like to?
No, respond.
Can I respond?
Yeah.
In the first place, let's get back to your first question. What did I do in the previous parliament to promote human rights? Chairperson, that goes back, maybe I must go back to 1987. In 1987, I was my first time elected to Parliament here, and about 40% in this very room, 40% of the newcomers in the then National Party caucus were members from different walks of life, academic life, business, farmers, etc. I wouldn't say many young people, but new people from different walks of life. And I was also responsible at my peril sometimes to work for the opening of membership to people, to all peoples for the National Party. Six of us started that campaign, and that also ended up in a very difficult situation. My that's not really concerned with human rights, particularly as per se, not maybe socio-economic rights, but particularly, Chairperson, it involves the human rights, the rights to vote, the right to get involved in politics. I also remember that in the 1983, that was before I entered Parliament, when they came with the previous tricameral constitution, in Bloemfontein, I actually opposed the tricameral constitution, and the reason was because it did not allow for black people. The then late Minister Heerners, he asked me to come and see him during tea time, which I did. And then he said to me, Dr. Van Heerden, come to Parliament, I know what you say. Come to Parliament and help me to achieve what you really say. 4 years later, we met each other after the elections in the lobby. And since then, there was a very close relationship between me and intellectual relationship between me and the then Minister Heerners. So yes, in that regard, I think I did my bit to open up situations for the new ventures to come, for the new dispensation to come. Let's get back to the more acute thing, Mr. Swart. Thank you also for your kind words. It's really good to be here again in a different situation. How do I see and what can be done? I to start with your last question. I don't think that the Human Rights Commission may be succeeded so far in getting the executive to task once they did not fulfill the expectations of the electorate. Can I again speak from my personal experience, Chairperson? I am at this stage practicing as an attorney now. I did the examination. There's a particular reason why I did that. I can now take instructions from the street, which I couldn't do while I was an advocate. I appeared in all courts. And my last court in which I appeared quite successfully was in the appeal division in Bloemfontein. But to get back, at this stage, I really suffered to get cooperation from yes, let me put it to the liquor, from the liquor board in the Free State particularly. I had a good relationship with Mr. Dukwani, who is the MEC for, amongst others, economic affairs in the Free State. But not only from the Free State. I was approached by another, in fact, by Checkers, who also ran into difficulties because they simply didn't get any response from the liquor boards. So I'm at this point in time, I'm busy trying to see whether I couldn't overcome that problem. It is a problem, yes. Unfortunately, the Access to Information Act, in that regard, which is also in the force within the ambit of the Human Rights Commission, maybe that's also something that I contributed to in a practice situation. I drafted a manual. You will recall that there was a time when all businesses were required to submit some manuals to the Human Rights Commission, and I was approached by auditors and accountants in Bloemfontein and in the Free State to draft a manual or manuals for distribution amongst these people. That I did. So then in the end it said it was no longer necessary. I think that the litigation, I did a lot of litigation. I tried to shy away from litigation because it's time-consuming and it is costly. There must be other ways. Now, the other way is by means of consultation, by means of an open channel of consultation. That's a better way. I wouldn't like litigation is always exciting, but there's always, unfortunately, seem to be a loser. And I know what I'm talking about. I've lost and I win cases, but it's not nice to lose, and it's a very costly affair. Be that as it may, I think the way in which one can overcome this problem is to by means of negotiation, consultation with the executive and the organs. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, may I ask a question which I think will address what I think other members here are also silently asking themselves? You and I come from the same stock. How is it that I feel that I am represented and part of this nation, and you, by contrast, represent a grouping that considers itself to be an unrepresented nation, and on that basis you have international contacts, and you mark for me in a sock met on a groupering of what full is unvertegenwoordig. So how is that possible? I come from the old Boer Republic before that.
Yeah, Freistaat.
My people before that from this corner of the country. So we come from the same place, but you feel unrepresented and I don't. Now, how does that fit with a Human Rights Commission which must look after the universal rights of all South Africans in this case, and all the people within our borders? Will you be there for special interests? The principle of self-determination was territorial in its nature, and Urania is its fruits. Will you be representing special Urania interests, or just how do you reconcile these different strands?
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity and this question. I think it is a question which should have been put to me. Unrepresented means internationally unrepresented, not nationally. Maybe I must also point out that in July recently, I was away in Canada, and I was approached by the Department of the International Relations and the Commission for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural, Religious, and so on minority groups via our head office. And I drafted a submission on minority issues. It was a request by the United Nations Forum, what's being called United Nations Forum on Minority Issues, which will take place in November in Geneva. And at the request of our Chief Secretary, I made a submission, and my submission was, part of my submission was contained in the final draft that was sent by the department to the United Nations. That's now I would like to get back to your question. How do I associate myself and our party as part of unrepresented, internationally unrepresented? There's no way in which the desires and let me first carry on. In this particular question from the UN, it's our identification of good practices in relation to minorities, political participation, challenges and problems facing minorities, participation of minorities in political processes and opportunities, initiatives and solutions. Amongst others, there are actually 14 to 15 points. I'm not going to burden you with that. But
I think you have clarified the issue of unrepresentativity. So let's go to the next phase of the question.
Good. The next phase.
Are you representing special interests?
The special interests of those section of the people who associate themselves with the more important sections of our party's policy, namely self-determination. And let me say this also at the outset: when I joined the Freedom Front, I said, you must convince me, not try to persuade me, but you must convince me about the viability of self-determination. You can never persuade me, convince me. They haven't done that until now, until this UNPO effort, which took me 15 months to prepare and make the submission in the Hague tour, where me and Dr. Mulder, we were there on two occasions. There's another dimension on self-determination which is different. I mean, if we go back to Principle 34 and Section 285, it says it makes provision for self-determination for those people belonging to ethnic, language, and religion minority groups to pursue the matter of self-determination in the same territorial area. And that is, there's no way. There's no way in which, and you refer to Urania, and I will get back to that.
I think you have answered the question.
Thank you, Mr. Rom.
That you'll be representing special interests. You are busy explaining that.
Thank you.
So the question has been answered on both.
Yes.
I'm sorry to...
No, thank you.
But we don't have a lot of time, so I'm trying to get us very pointed. Thank you. Are there other questions?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Dr. Van der Yerden. Having studied African history, how do you see yourself promoting human rights culture, particularly in respect of traditional law and African customs, which on the face of it might be a challenge to human rights in South Africa? The second question, what are your strengths and weaknesses? Thank you.
Let's start with my weaknesses. My greatest weakness is that I do not speak any unfortunately any black language. Although my wife majored in Sotho and so did my children. Be that as it may, I can't. They are not before the committee. I am. That's my greatest weakness, I would say. About my strengths, I would say a long life in the academic atmosphere, where your approach to issues is different from you are always critical. Professor, you will know, you're always critical in everything that you approach. That's why I was critical when we had to vote about Principle 34. I would say that, and then the other strength is my long political exposure in different capacities, the constitutional but also in the legal capacity. Your first question, I'm not quite sure whether I understood that. You said something about the challenge. I missed that one.
Recap, I asked the question about your studies in African history.
Yeah.
Having studied African history, how do you see yourself promoting, and I want to underline promoting, human rights, culture, in respect of traditional law and African customs, which, on the face of it, might pose a challenge to human rights in South Africa?
I think it will amplify human rights. I've got a great appreciation for tradition. That's my background. And I think that it can enrich and it can amplify human rights. I even spoke about His Royal Highness next to you. We know one another for quite a while in a different situation, but I've got a great appreciation for people who cherish their culture. Can I just give you another example? Our daughter-in-law is a Polish lady, and we were there recently. Jefferson, not only them, but in certain of the old Eastern European countries which we visited, they cherish their culture. They sing, they get together, they dress culturally. I've got a great appreciation for that. That can only, in my opinion, enrich human rights, culture, traditional law, and so on. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you, bro. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah. Quite a number of questions. I mean, firstly, Dr. Van Heerden, do you support Clause 9 of the Constitution, the Equality Clause, that nobody should be unfairly discriminated against on the basis of a whole lot of issues, race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, color, sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera? Do you support all of that? No discrimination against unmarried women, gays and lesbians, et cetera. Do you support that? That would be the first question. Secondly, the requirement is that there's expertise and experience in the field of human rights. You were an academic from 1968 to 1986 before you went into Parliament. Did you ever write anything critical of the crime against humanity that was apartheid, or the abuses that were going on? In your period as a National Party MP from 87 to 94, did you ever do anything about the, I mean, that was at the time of death squads, of the worst repression in the country's history. Can you show us anything that you did to oppose that at all? Then just, I'm afraid I'm lost on the Afrikaners being internationally unrepresented. And if that is the case, then are you, as part of this group, maybe taking steps to ensure that Zulu-speaking people also can belong to this forum, because they must be internationally unrepresented as well, Tshivenda-speaking people, etc., etc., because this is, after all, a country of minorities. I mean, there's no one ethnic language group that is in the majority, so surely everybody then should be internationally represented. And then lastly, you took the government to court as part of the old tricameral parliament pension fund, on the basis that you were being unfairly discriminated against. I don't know if you want to tell us a bit about that, because the government was putting more money into the new pension fund. One of the issues I think us new members have is you know, that it's people who were in the Tri-Cam Parliament are getting two pensions. They're getting a pension already from the Tri-Cam, and they're then contributing to their new one, which most people here were not able to do. But anyway, you did that then. Lastly, you know, you speak about, you praise that you don't speak any African languages. You speak Afrikaans, English, German, and Latin, and you're now trying to learn Polish. Why are you not trying to learn one of the African languages?
Let me start in with the last one, why I'm not trying to learn any of the African languages. Chairperson, I think that particular now, South Africa actually has become a little black England as far as languages are concerned. So you can get along with English, even if I speak a broken English, my Free State English. I'm sure that one can get along, and one can rather spend your energy and attention to mastering something else or some other things. As far as Polish, my trying to get a working knowledge about Polish, that's just for a conversation, just to say hi, dzień dobry, and dziękuję, etc. Just a few things, Chairperson. Now, to get back to my pension case, that's actually my favorite topic. I worked 3 years on that case. I was successful. I was the applicant. I used two other counsel to do the case for me. I was successful four times in the High Court division here, and then it was taken to the Constitutional Court, where it was the appeal of the government.
What
now, the yes, yeah. Now to get back to that actually links also up with Section 9, the Equality Court clause, because it was upheld because according to the judgment, the High Court gave judgment regarding formal equality, based its decision on formal equality, and then the Constitutional Court said, but they should also take attention to substantial equality. And being a lawyer, I said that it differs from the judgment, but I accept. Of course, you accept it, and that's now the law. Yes, I do accept Chapter 9. I know you will definitely have a follow-up question after that, but be that as it may, let me just carry it further on. Amongst the people I was the applicant on behalf of 147 people. Out of the 147, two people were black, 11 were from Indian origin, 6 were women, and then 28 were brown people from brown origin. I don't want to use the word colored, but in any case it was used in the court case as colored. And I still think that those people got a raw deal. You remember, you also referred to two pensions. They are also, that's not, it doesn't hold water, because they are in Parliament, and they were at that stage in Parliament, quite a number of people coming from the homelands of the self-governing countries in South Africa,
TBCC countries and the six other self-governing countries. They also get a pension. So that doesn't... in other words, they also qualify then for a second pension. That's not really the issue. Two pensions, a double pension, isn't the case. Now let's get back further on to that pension case. Definitely contributed to reopening. I asked that question. I was also part of the Musaneki task team representing the NCOP. I asked that question. What influence did my pension case, which I lost, have to reconsider the bad situation of members of parliament? And that was just, it wasn't confirmed, chairperson, but it was indicated that you will never know the importance of that. About the death squad, I never knew about any death squads. I was in the army, yes. Yes, I was in the army. Chairperson, it's one thing, I was in the artillery. And it's one thing, I was in 1976 there and again in 1983. It's one thing to be, and I was in charge of four artillery weapons. It's one thing to give your guns instruction to land the projectiles on certain identified targets. That's one thing. That's another thing, and that was absolutely a great experience. And the next time I encountered these people was at Kudesa, sitting like this, in the same situation. That's a different situation. Then suddenly you realize, but you grew up and you were trained in a different situation, and then these people, they also, and I want to fall back also on my postgraduate studies, which I did with the students. Suddenly, you are bringing together to discuss the future of the country. As far as the what do they do to expose human rights, I think I've already touched on that. To the extent that chairperson, right from the once they started with the tricameral constitution, I was opposed, and I said you cannot.
Yeah, but sorry, my question was, you were an academic from 1968 to 1986. Or somewhere around there. Did you ever write anything that opposed apartheid? Remember, apartheid had been declared a crime against humanity, so you were happy with it.
No.
Okay.
I didn't. Maybe can I say,
yes.
I didn't write anything, chairperson. I was also, I wrote something privately for Kubi Kutsir to have the old Free State Republic Act against the Indians repealed. I did that for
privately.
Privately. That was privately done, yes.
Okay, and you couldn't come out with it publicly. Author of a number of history and law articles in professional journals. Not one of them could have opposed the fact that Indians were not allowed to sleep in the Orange Free State. And then also, just going back, Chair, I'll finish now. I mean, you know, you were a member of Parliament in 1987. Height of the, I think the elections are, they were in April, May. Okay. I remember I was in detention. Height of the repression. Activists disappearing left, right, and center. You're a member of parliament. You're a member of the Justice Committee, according to your CV. You don't seem to ask what is happening. That's all. You don't need to answer that.
Ms. Adams? Let's borrow...
I just want to know, did you practice at the Free State Bar as an advocate?
No.
Not there.
I was practicing. Let me go back. I did my pupillage at the Free State Bar, and I was elected to Parliament before I could do the examination. And according to the General Bar's regulations, you are not allowed to do the examination if you are in any other occupation. I tried several times, at least three times, to get permission to write the examination, because I was the examination was in August and I was elected in May. So I didn't do the examination. I approached I was advised by people high up in the legal profession. You did your utmost, start practicing, which I did, and I never took any instructions from the street.
Okay, but my follow-up question is actually, Given the fact that you have quite an extensive legal background, did you contribute in any way to the transformation within the legal field, and more specifically in the Free State?
Not as far as training is concerned. What I did, I can tell you, let me just get back to one particular case, which I did. There are many. But this particular case, I did the it was an appeal case. The person was sentenced to twice life sentences and then 15 years as well. I prepared the heads of argument, and then I was asked to give my heads of that was for the legal aid board. I was asked to give these heads of argument over to someone else because I'm now a member of parliament. And then I gave it to another advocate, which came to me and said, but how? Why did you spend such a lot of attention to this particular case? I said, but why? What do you mean? This is only a legal aid matter, and I think my fee was less than 2,000 rand. Yes, I did my utmost for a client, whether it's black or doesn't matter what color it was. Yes, in that regard, I think I did my utmost for my clients, whether they were, it doesn't matter what color they are. That's it. But I didn't do any crime.
Thank you. Advocate?
As long as we have proper instructions.
Absolutely.
Please,
sir, you have a long life with an important career, so I feel inhibited to perhaps express what I feel like expressing, but I need to do my job as you did yours. And in doing my job today, I cannot help but echoing some of the concerns that Mr. Jeffrey voiced, and I want to put a few things to you to enable you perhaps to address them, because I too was involved in that negotiation, and it was like being in a time war for me, because what was coming out of your group was very low in terms of enlightenment, perhaps with the exception of Tertius Delport. There was flat opposition to second-generation human rights, flat opposition to the vertical application of the Bill of Rights, flat opposition to things like abortion or sexual orientation, the equality clause. I mean, that it was really, for me, was a shock, and was impregnated with a culture which I can only define as autocratic, hierarchical, paternalistic. And the job of a commissioner is not just to defend human rights, but to promote a culture of human rights, which is rooted in enlightenment. So since you raised the issue of your qualification around that seminal time of shaping the Constitution, and I experienced being on the other side, what was to me at the time a shocking cultural mindset. The question is, have you changed? Are those positions, 15 years have gone, we all change, speak Latin, appreciate tempora mutat and et nos with illa. So time change and we change with them. But would you be a strong advocate of gay marriages? Would you be a strong advocate for the right of abortion? Would you, and I would like to have a yes or no answer. Would you be a strong advocate of a second generation human rights, like the right to housing, the right to a decent job, and so on and so forth?
Thank you. Mr. Ambrosini, yes, I find it, just a remark, it's amazing that you refer to the situation at CODESA. I remember that in working group two, me and I'm going to mention the name of Ben Ngubani, we often got together to resist certain things in the Constitution. And you will also remember Professor Willem Olivier, the late Professor Willem Olivier. We had long discussions. I beg your pardon? Yes, I know that. I know you very well from university as well as from the legal profession. To now suddenly become the innocent person from you I doubt that you were not from the, then you were not sincere. But to get back, no, to say that you guys, to put the blame on us, the people that you represent there were also a lot reluctant to accept certain things. But be that as it may, I would like to answer your questions. The question that you ask, will I did I change? Yes, I did change. And will I canvass for gay marriages and abortion now? I beg your pardon?
Even though those rights have been asserted by the Constitution, so as a commissioner you would not...
No, I can't. It doesn't affect my party, but my personal opinion is that even, and let's take the matter of abortion. It's still not settled. Which life is more important, the unborn baby or the privacy of the mother requesting abortion? But let's not open, Chairperson, a discussion in that regard. No, your answer to the question is no.
Thank you very much. Doctor, we thank you for presenting yourself to the committee and wish you all the luck. Thank you for the efforts for coming before us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, also to members of the committee. Thank you very much for penetrating questions, and good luck to you as well.
Thank you.
By Worcester 8.
The question is to whether you would like to be full-time or part-time.
Doctor, would you like to be full-time or part-time if appointed? Full-time or part-time?
Full-time or part-time?
Yeah, if appointed.
If appointed? Chairperson, I think that part-time can be exciting. Full-time, well, full-time, it all depends. But part-time as well, yes. I think part-time, if one can carry on. Full-time, I'm sure one will not be in a position to carry on with your practice. Yeah. And I don't want to leave my practice. So part-time, preferably, if I were to be appointed.
Thank you. Thank you, Lex. Thank you. Let's get Bonan in. Colin, to bring that other person in. And so we're losing time now. We're
going to look for his friend.
Sorry?
We're going to look for his friend.
Ah, that is friend. That's not good, you know. Actually, it's unethical what happened. Very much. I'm angry with it. Very angry with it. You know?
No.
I think this has to. From some official complaints. It's really unacceptable. Totally unacceptable. You can't have that situation.
Anymore. Who's the other one? Besides this one. Where's this one? Where's she? Where's she? Where's this one?
That other... No, she's not here yet.
She's not here?
No, no, she's not here yet. I haven't seen her, but it's just an odd thing.
How would you go into the bathroom on the mountain?
The Constitution does not assist either abortion.
Please, come in, come in, come in, sit here. Next to that water bottle there. Yeah, over there. Thanks. Okay, let's resume. Please, members, let's resume. Meeting is called to order. Thank you. Sir, you are welcome here. My name is Ngongoro Mathuli, chair of the committee, and the names of commissioners, of members, not commissioners, are over there. You can identify them. The one who doesn't have a name in front of him is Dr. Ambrosini. We'll ask you to introduce yourself. Tell us the reasons why you want to be appointed or nominated to the commission, and very briefly, very, very brief synopsis about your experience relating to human rights. Then we'll lead you along with other questions. Thanks. Welcome.
Thanks.
Press the on the right hand side. Yeah, you'll see. Yeah, okay. There.
My name is Andy Mutama. Let me just quickly say that I was born up on a farm from parents of farm workers in the Potchefstroom area, now Northwest. Studied sociology from, of course, my low primary education in the farm, I got to township. And since I left university, I've worked for about 10 years in the human rights sector, starting with working for the National Land Committee, which is the network, national network of NGOs dealing specifically with land-related issues, land tenure, land redistribution, you could say also agrarian reform. But also, as a student, I was involved as a leader in the Black Consciousness Movement. I was a student leader, in fact, was national president at one point of Azasim, which is linked to Azapo. But of course, since then, I have sort of moved away from formalized political formations, and I've been a member of civil society, and in particular social movements, which has emerged after 1994, relating to, again, the land issue in a broad way, socioeconomic rights, trying to link them to pressurize government, quite frankly, agitate, to lobby. I've been, in fact, to Parliament a few times. Honorable Advocate Lumisa here, I've appeared before him, lobbying for changes in legislation, particularly relating to farm workers and labor tenants and the whole redistribution restitution process. Why do I want to be a commissioner? Colleagues in the civil society have suggested that I could make an interesting commissioner, and having looked at the lackluster almost nature of the commission to date, I do think that I might make it look or be slightly interesting in how it deals with issues that have come before it, and being proactive as well, and being slightly robust. I think I have also dealt with the commission. Even now, we're doing some work around the national action plan, which should have been, which should happen almost immediately after the World Conference Against Racism. I have appeared before the Human Rights Commission, arguing as a member of civil society and a citizen on issues, for instance, of the Black Forum. Black Forum, journalists for Black Forum. I mean, the whole thing about complaints of the 702. I went and tried to assist the commission in conceptualizing the race problem. And I do think that the commission has been too legalistic in its interpretation, and I don't think that it understands the social questions that are historically created better. I didn't feel like this, and even look at the decision that made on that issue. Maybe that should be more or less sufficient.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable sir, you want to follow the line? Thank you.
Good day and welcome. Good to have you here. Just in some general comments about, you made the initial comment about the lackluster performance of the commission and its relationship with the executive. How would you, as a commissioner, improve that working of the commission vis-a-vis the executive, in particular the reporting of departments on socioeconomic rights, the issue of complaints that are laid? We've heard of thousands of complaints that are laid with the commission where departments are very tardy in responding to that. How would you, as a commissioner, respond to that? And secondly, how would you see the commission's relationship with Parliament? And then thirdly, the issue of being very involved in the NGO, the Landless People's Organization, People's Movement. Just a little bit more background about that. Would you support land invasions, for example? A direct question. Particularly in view of the Constitutional Court's findings on that issue. And we'd just like to thank you very much and welcome. It's nice to have you here.
Okay, thank you. It seems to me that the commission, in terms of just being effective in getting to that, there must be a relationship, the two ways, of course. I think that if the relationship between Parliament and Commission itself is that they can provide oversight and ask for accounting at that level, and hopefully Parliament can exert its influence there, which would work. But I'm advised that, in fact, there's nothing that stops the Commission if it's not satisfied to litigate, in fact, even to subpoena this department to come before it. See, the problem has been, even when information has been provided, what do you do with that information? And is it true, though, that the only institutions that can call and the executive to account is the commission? I'm not sure. It seems to me that we need to find a better working relationship at many different levels, and so that some sort of a pressure can be put where there's been lack of deliverance. But the commission, if it has these powers, I think that it has to be slightly open. I think it's not going to be a very comfortable situation, I imagine, when the commission calls departments to account, when in fact they are also elected members of parliament by society. I suppose the expectation is that ultimately the responsibility should lay with them. So that relationship should be strengthened. I do think that the commission should be able to come before parliament and in front of society and say, we have adopted all the mechanisms that we have, and now this matter must be handled by you. I haven't yet said that. In fact, this is a as related to the last question, I suppose, about the land invasion, I would call it land occupation, reoccupation. I have a great difficulty with rejecting people occupying land when they're desperate and landless. Personally, I find it that I can't defend that. I can't defend governments bringing heavy-handedness on desperately poor people. In fact, all the situations where people have occupied land, it has not been because they want this land for making money or anything like that. It's more
to get settlement. In fact, it's an indictment on our constitution and our democracy that we have people who are so desperate that they'll move on to occupying land. I would actually hold government accountable. I'll call the responsible department. I'd like to know what have they done to avoid this situation happening. We're wasting too much time in this country, taking these people to court, creating this sort of heavy-handedness. Every local government these days has called something they call anti-eviction sort of committees. You would have thought that we have a land redistribution committee. By the way, we've only redistributed 5% of the land since 1994. It means to reach the 30% of the land, you're going to need 30 years. I don't know, you know, when I think about the commission, whether it can be proactive enough to say if there are these sort of targets the government set, then there's a problem here. 5%, it means that we are not going to meet the target of 2014 on this question.
Thank you very much. You have answered the question. Honorable Smith.
Would you like to pick up where you left off? You said very interestingly that you found the Human Rights Commission's ruling on the Black Journalism Forum's revival excessively legalistic and that they hadn't taken into account the sociological fact. Would you like to expand on that? And then from there, just go to the second question, please. I read yesterday in an article by Max de Pria in Rapport that you produce or edit a journal called Frank Talk. And on his version, you, amongst many other people, are at the moment practicing inflammatory racial language or sentiment. And I had not heard about your publication or perhaps as an online platform. But please tell me, what is in Frank Talk? Why is this the queer think that it's racism? Can you do that for me?
Yes. I don't think that Mr. Dupree is a particularly reliable or useful judgment of what is racism. I mean, following his writing myself very closely. But New Frank Talk is a publication that I indeed publish. And in it, our latest title says, Blacks Can't Be Racist. In fact, it's a long exposition of the historical involvement of the race question. And responding, in fact, to the ruling of the commission itself. And so, you know, I don't know what more one can say except that I'm racist and inflammatory. Maybe it might be useful to read this publication and see for yourself.
Is the heading of the article?
Absolutely.
And then the first question, the follow-up to the other question, what does that?
Okay.
Maybe just to say that what was stating about that ruling was that the commission believes that black people cannot form black-owned organizations to fight against racism, which they confronted with at work and in society and everywhere else. I think that it angered me in some ways because it's almost like going back to pre-1968 with the Bigot movement where white people have to speak for us, we can't speak for ourselves. But also it is absurd. It would suggest that women can't have women's own organization in a patriarchal sexist society. And so that's basically, you know, my objection to that ruling. And I do think that even legally it's wrong if you look at case law, quite frankly.
Thank you. Rob?
Thank you, Chair. Mfokam Kutama, any of you to think the Human Rights Commission has been successful during the last 15 years or so? Second question. Please share with the panel your strengths and weaknesses.
It's hard to say that the commission has been successful. And again, I'm looking at a narrow area where I have been involved on the land question and tenure related questions and issues of racism that crop up from time to time, including, you know, the xenophobic sort of attacks. The commission did respond like most of society on those xenophobic attacks, which I'll call necrophobia, by the way, because we don't attack everyone else. We attack black people from the African continent. But should the commission take sole responsibility for that? I mean, I have a difficulty, but I do think that there is legislative democracy on these strategic questions that are facing us in terms of the transformation of our society. So there's this major unevenness there, I think. My strengths and weaknesses. I think the biggest strength I bring is that I speak straight and I speak my mind. and I am not particularly worried about what politicians and people who pay me think, so I am sufficiently reckless in that regard, and I do think that for some things to happen in this country, we're going to need a bit of that sort of thing. I mean, this sort of appropriateness, collegiality, which at the end of the day puts us where we are, is dangerous for all of us in the long run. This country's constitution, I do think that it's facing a major legitimacy crisis because we are failing to provide what we should. I mean, we're building, one of the things I keep on asking, you build an RDP house. This is a reproduction of a racist construct. Who can live in an RDP house? I would have expected the Human Rights Commission, for instance, to say, what is the content of this right to housing? And if we argue that and we bring some sort of measures, we then say to government, no, you can't build that house. It is not good for human existence. It is not good for black people. It is not good for equality. It's not good for the values that we're trying to project. So, yes, I think this is the biggest strength. Maybe my weakness is that I argue hard for my position, and you need to have colleagues that, in a sense, are able to withstand that. So I do think, though, that once the matter has been properly reflected on and canvassed, I am happy to go with the majority, but if the principal question remains, then I will not go with a majority that reproduces a problematic situation. And I will make that very clear.
Thank you. Vijay?
Yeah, I mean, you've got a very strong NGO background, I mean, which is quite clear from your CV. The Human Rights Commission is different. It's not an NGO. It's a quasi-government body, I mean, provided for in our constitution. Do you think that your being on it is going to constrain you? That, you know, as a being part of non-government organizations, you can organize how you like, you can say how you like, whereas once, if you're part of the commission, if you're a commissioner, there's going to be a lot of constraints on that. It may result in your having to stop some of your writings because of perceived conflicts of interest. Commissioners are also adjudicators in terms of complaints. You may have to stop some of your writing in terms of public writing in terms of perceptions then that you've got a bias because you've expressed a strong view in a particular way. The other is government is a strange and sort of difficult animal. It's much easier being outside making demands. It's much more difficult actually getting government to respond, and to some extent the commission has to play that role as well, or at least be sensitive to government or the constraints on government. So what I'm really asking is, have you know, what's your comment on what I've said, would you be prepared to limit some of your activities if you were made a commissioner, or would you want to carry on as before and be a commissioner?
It would be nice to do both. But no, look, obviously, saying I'm available for this sort of work suggests that one has to find ways to work which would have maximum impact from the point of view of the institution that one is associated with. I struggle to understand, though, that what sort of constraints would they necessarily be, at least in terms of the sort of values that I hold and I obviously will bring to the commission at that level of the commission work. So if, yeah, as you say, there will be a desire for me not to write columns, I'm sure listen to my colleagues, and they will have to argue hard why that prevents us doing the work that we should do as a collective. I'm open to that. I'm not married to doing just one thing, and I do believe that I have reached a point where I can make a contribution at another level. So for me, I don't think it's a big problem. And also to say that in civil society, it's a problematic area because I'm not a leader of civil society. society. I don't, my influence, if there's any, is only because people think maybe what I'm saying makes sense, and that's how one has got some credibility. But one does not have the sort of political party sort of influence.
Thank you. Dr. Basil?
Sir, let me premise by saying that I like and admire your passion, and I think that the issue you raise are real issues which ought to be debated. The issue that goes through my mind, and perhaps through the mind of others, is whether, as you have articulated, those issues and the passion belong to an institution which is bound to apply the law and not to make the law. The Human Rights Commission needs to passionately, much more than it's done so far, but it needs to enforce the rights as they do exist now, as they may, with all their shortcomings as they may be, cannot formulate opinions, cannot formulate ideas beyond the strict parameters of what's on the books now. You do not have a legal background, so you have the the latitude of deal with the ideas and the passions that ideas express. So the simple question to you, it's a very simple one. Would you serve on a part-time basis? Because perhaps the commission needs somebody like you.
Yeah, no, I'll be happy to consider that proposition, and to if people believe that would serve the commission better, to hear a different voice from that sort of engagement. I mean, I'm happy to consider that. But the latter question you raise has got to do with the application of law and vis-a-vis whether the commission can make law. I mean, doesn't make law, of course. But my point is that even within the given possibilities, I don't think that we have done enough. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, you're right, but I read what the Constitution says this institution should do, and even the act that gives life to these institutions. And I don't get anything that suggests that they cannot be more proactive than they've been. I don't see a great tension there. I mean, the protection of tenure rights is given in our law. We have evicted 1 million farm workers, and with no possibility of protecting these people. And the law is very clear about that, and our constitution as well. I do think that if we make this determination about what is strategically important in terms of where we come from, our history, the commission and I think even parliament can do more. I mean, people talk about the willing buyer, willing seller, but our constitution doesn't say we must stick to that, in fact. There is already provision within our constitution for the possibility for government to enter the market, the land market, much more aggressive than it has been able to do.
Thank you. Advocate.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want clarity on your answer regarding the question from Dr. Ambrosini as to whether you'd like to be a full-time or a part-time member of the commission. And secondly, regarding the question of land, what do you believe, what would you want to see the commission do as a member in order to accelerate the question of distribution of land? And also, regarding the matter of the Constitution promotes, among other things, cultural diversity. And there are certain cultural practices that have shown to be problematic in certain instances, like circumcision, bukutwala, and virginity inspection. What is your view? What do you believe because the commission ought to do in order to deal with the problems that arise from those practices? Should they be done away with, for instance, or is there anything that can be done to make them align themselves with the imperatives of the Constitution?
Okay, in terms of whether one, look, I know there's a possibility of a full-time commissioner and a part-time commissioner. it would be good, I think, to be a full-time commissioner. But if, for whatever reason, one would be considered to provide a better input as a part-time, I'm happy to consider it. I mean, this is my response to that. What the commission could have done to assist government, for instance, on the land redistribution aspect. You know, we had the National Land Summit where all the stakeholders, landowners and government, everybody met. And there was a long list, for instance, of resolutions which guided us almost out of the impasse. And nothing happened. I do think that if somebody was paying slightly a bit of attention, could have said, but look, already on this area we have some propositions. Can we be slightly proactive about government taking the responsibility and making sure these resolutions are being implemented? And I'm sure the commission should be able to do that sort of thing. And of course, in those resolutions, one of them is that it was not a review. Government, the ANC or the ruling party, kept on saying, for instance, we need to review the willing seller, willing buyer. But I mean, that summit was very clear that willing buyer, willing seller does not work. So you can't keep on saying you're going to review this thing. A decision by stakeholders has already been arrived at. On the questions of the cultural diversity, I have personally come very strong out on the issue of circumcision as initiation, not so much circumcision, but the initiation in most of our language groups. I have a difficulty to understand why would we sustain a practice such as that in the 21st century based on a conception of creating a man in what I consider a very patriarchal recreation of manhood. I do think that there must be ways of initiating young people into womanhood and manhood, which is different, which is based on a different set of values than the patriarchal recreation. So in a sense, it's an internal attack on what I perceive to be a problematic construct of masculinity. And of course, then you have death, and you have the whole problem of amputations and all that goes with it, which, where I come from, that magnify an already deep problem, which is, I want to know, in the 21st century, which we live in right now, why would we want to take a boy to the mountain and butcher them in the way we do? And I have no difficulty in understanding the Eurocentric attack on things black. But you see, we cannot detain ourselves because of racism of white people against things which are black, and therefore we find ourselves unable to transform and to reject practices because we worry that in this way we're inscribing the historical attack on things black. So this is, I think, an internal critique. Oktuala means basically grabbing young girls and turning them into women, into wives of people. Again, I don't think that's consistent with a lot of what we consider to be Ubuntu, and I think also what the Constitution would like to do, and the general sense of good citizenship and living amongst people. So, yes, if it is a cultural tradition to abduct young girls and or any other language group's tradition, I think that there's a problem. For now, for instance, I believe that by taking a position that says Ulwalugo and Uktuala must be abolished, is forcing a conversation in society which is not happening. I'll be very happy to listen to arguments why we should recuperate this in a way that is consistent with the values that I think that we should uphold.
Well, thank you very much for presenting and being here. Very interesting listening to your views. You are very strong. Thank you very much, and lots of good luck. Thank you.
I need it. Thank you.
Thanks. Ciao. I think we have a problem. The next candidate is not here.
She is on the phone. She is somewhere up there coming to Cape Town.
Up where?
In the sky, like she. I've just received an SMS to say that she missed the flight and she got one on about 5. We should land at 7. So, yeah, maybe anytime between 7 and half past 7 she should be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
I don't know if you know the time for you to the public, but I don't know if she can make it like that.
She should have been here to wait for us. We can start there in the morning, but I'm not very sure if we should be able to do it. We'll see. I don't know. You will reschedule it for tomorrow. You give us 15 minutes. Plus, we are interviewing 11 people tomorrow.
Chair, I think you could maybe just find out from her tomorrow what happened. But you give a short space of time.
Very, very short.
The first interview is just up past night, so maybe we can start with it at night.
Are we able to start at 9? We can start at 9 with her until up past 9.
Okay.
So that we don't interfere with the other people.
The tomorrow's one will be in March M46. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I think we have worked a bit. Well, let's have that.